The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Devastating news from the Football League as Bury's final hope is in vain and they are kicked out of the Football League. Better news for Bolton Wanderers, whose takeover finally goes through. On the pitch, Colchester and Crawley provide the big surprises in the Carabao Cup. We'll preview the Premier League games, including the North London Derby, and we'll look ahead to the Old Firm. There's the UEFA Player of the Year, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, lovely to see you.
Hello.
You're wearing shorts.
I am.
Is this after the chafing experience of White Hart Lane?
Yeah, well, it's very much shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, but, you know, that was very unpleasant.
Paul McInnes.
Hi, I'm just thinking about Barry's horse bolting there, but yeah, nice to see you.
Nice to see you too. Michael Butler, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Right, let's start with the sad news from the Football League. While Bolton Wanderers have had a stay of execution after their takeover was completed, Bury Football Club have gone out of business. The one man who's done more work on this than anyone else at The Guardian is David Conn. He's on the line now. David, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
It looked sort of last Friday like Bury had been saved. The new buyers pulled out. How come?
Well, I mean, it wasn't even that it looked like they were saved, really. It was just that at the very, it wasn't the 11th hour, but it was at the 10th hour of the final day, two people had said they were interested in buying Bury. It was as distant as that. They hadn't even, the owner, Steve Dale, hadn't even, I don't think, engaged with them before that. And so they were given till Tuesday, 5 p.m., to try to actually conclude a deal, which was obviously desperately quick for people to spend millions of pounds and take on, you know, a financial ruin. And it wasn't that surprising that on Tuesday, 3 p.m., they said, we just don't like the look of it and we just think that there's problems there that can't be resolved. In particular, a mortgage on Gig Lane itself, which is ultimately where the money's ultimately come in from 8 British Virgin Islands companies, which, you know, obviously that's what's going to happen at, you know, Gig Lane Bury, just off Manchester Road. You're going to have a £3.7 million mortgage with ultimately a company in Malta and 8 BVI companies standing behind it. And that really is, I think, a symbol of you know, part of what's wrong with English football, not just football finances, you know, finances in this country. It's just, you know, what on earth is that doing on a football ground like Gig Lane?
And when you have to dig down into the detail and you start talking about CVAs and stripping assets and things, I think it's probably quite easy for fans to switch off, because we follow football because we want to follow football. We don't want to follow business. But how much of a, hear this phrase a lot, a wake-up call, how much of a wake-up call is this? And it, you know, it's one that's too late for Bury Football Club.
Yeah, and you know, just saying that it's too late for Bury Football Club, you know, that is really, really upsetting in itself, before we start talking about will lessons be learned and will it be a wake-up call. And someone was saying to me yesterday, We didn't want Bury Football Club to be sacrificed on the altar of an example. You know, well, we'll make an example of one.
Sure.
Because it should have been avoided. It should never have been allowed to happen. We shouldn't have needed a wake-up call. And I accept that you're saying, you know, people don't necessarily want to know about the financial details. But a lot of football supporters, you know, are very literate and are increasingly literate about these things and are prepared and do understand what the details are and understand when something looks completely wrong. And you know, I did write, one of the pieces I wrote was a little bit more personal than some of the others, that, you know, I've got very personal roots in Bury. You know, I'm from North Manchester, 5 miles down the road from Gig Lane, and I went to school in Bury. So it's a, you know, I didn't grow up a Bury fan, but I grew up going to Gig Lane and going past Gig Lane twice a day and just knowing what a lovely ground Gig Lane is, and it's always been there. But for the people that are actual Bury fans. It's just been awful seeing how devastated they are.
I'm just wondering whether there is, you know, this is, it's actually representative of a sort of broader, more long-term trend where a lot of smaller clubs are going to be on the precipice of being solvent or not.
Well, I think that people who are looking at this as a wake-up call for Leagues 1 and 2 might be missing that the most financially toxic division is the Championship.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually the division where very big financial losses are still being made every year, which absolutely dwarf the sort of money we're talking about at Bury. And where you've got increasingly overseas owners who are buying Championship clubs for, you know, the, I don't want to call it a gamble, but for the jackpot of being promoted to the Premier League. And obviously the big structural problem is the gap financially between the Premier League and the EFL, because the Premier League is a breakaway league by the top clubs so that they wouldn't have to share their money. So it's not as if the financial gap is some kind of accident. And so clubs that are relegated or clubs that are overspending to try and get promoted, I mean, there's huge losses being made in the Championship. And if an alarm bell should be rung, I would be ringing it there. Yes, it's a struggle in Leagues 1 and 2, but I've just got limited sympathy for the idea that the problem in Leagues 1 and 2 is the gap with the Premier League. Because, first of all, if the owners are not of a certain calibre, would you really want the Premier League giving multi-millions to those clubs? What would be happening to those millions? And also, they just do have to try and live within their means. You know, Bury didn't really have the right to overspend on borrowed money, on mortgaged grounds, on money from a property company that was also on shaky grounds, to sign players they could not afford, to win a promotion that with players that they couldn't afford to pay. And that's part of the reason why the EFL board in the end took a firm stance, because the board is only representing the other clubs, you know, is representing the clubs. And there was a limit to the sympathy of other clubs, because they feel like Bury got a promotion against them, you know, competing against other clubs that they couldn't afford while other clubs are trying to pay their way.
The more I read about Stuart Day and Steve Dale and Ken Anderson at Bolton, the more contempt I hold for them. What are your feelings towards them?
Well, Ken Anderson, let's start with each one, and let's put it in the context of this thing called the fit and proper person's test. It's not actually called that anymore. It's called the owners and directors test, the more neutral. The league doesn't even call it a fit and proper person's test anymore, but that's what it used to be called, and that's what people think it is. People think that there is a process by which people are assessed as to whether they are fit and proper. But it's not fit and proper in the way that people and football supporters would think of that, and in which, in our own lives, we know what fit and proper means, what we feel like it means, what it looks like, in terms of people we know, in terms of people we respect. All it means is, have you got, and I understand they have to have a legal test, because they do get challenged. They, you know, Massimo Cellino challenged them, you know, with QCs, and won and stayed in control of Leeds. So I know they have to have a firm test, but basically, if you have not got an unspent conviction for dishonesty, for an offence which involves dishonesty, and you're not disqualified as a director or disqualified as a football person, you can basically take over a football club. It's not, do you have, what are your plans for the club? They're supposed to be, have you got the money for the club? But Steve Dale took over without ever satisfying that rule, without complying with that rule. And that is the reason, isn't it, why Bury got expelled in the end, because he took over, but he never did satisfy the league that he had what they call proof of funding, that he had the money. And so these guys, in turn, Ken Anderson, Stuart Day, Steve Dale, they all passed what is thought of as the fit and proper persons test because none of them had unspent convictions for dishonesty and were not disqualified directors at the time that they took over the clubs. And what we have here is Bury Football Club out of the Football League and probably going into liquidation after 134 years. They survived two world wars and 70 years since the last one. And now they're pretty much gone after 9 months of Steve Dale's ownership. And Ken Anderson obviously took another great historic Northwest stalwart of English football to the brink.
The EFL, how much criticism should be levelled at them?
I'm probably more moderate than some people, right? I recognise that after the last round of clubs going into administration in 2000 to 2002, and a bit after, of which Bury Football Club were one, which again makes it kind of unforgivable that the club itself, people at the club itself, allowed it to get into this situation again. The EFL did bring the fit and proper persons test in after that. They have got financial regulation. There's people at the EFL who really do try. And Debbie Jevons, the chair of the EFL, has been making the point while she's been doing her interviews that it is the clubs themselves that make the rules. And it is true that people at the EFL centrally, they want to improve the rules, but they have to get the clubs themselves to agree to stronger rules governing them, if you see what I mean. And that's always been the challenge. Do these club owners want a firmer, better, broader fit and proper persons test? Do they want better financial controls? Well, the answer to that second one is no, because they haven't agreed to proper, strong financial controls in Leagues 1 and 2. They've got this salary control where the owners are still allowed to put money in as long as it goes in shares, not in loans, right? So they're not strictly living within... It's not like financial fair play, which is properly saying you can't make losses even if the owner's going to put money in. And that does protect clubs financially. This one, Stuart Day, was complying with the financial regulation, but then he couldn't put... And same with Eddie Davis. But then they couldn't put money in anymore, and the club's gone. The club's a ruin. So the EFL is now saying... Yes, we know we've got to improve the rules. We know we're having a governance review, and Debbie Jevons has been talking about a salary cap. But she's been saying quite justifiably that it's the clubs themselves that have got to come round to governing this game better.
Damian Collins, the chairman of the Digital, Cultural, Media and Sport Committee, saying that maybe the government should provide legislation that gives the FA the power or sets up a regulator, you know, much like Ofcom regulate broadcasters, etc., an independent one. That seems to be a good idea, right?
Yeah, but the problem is people have been saying that for the last 20 years or even 25 years, right? And we've seen government after government have an inquiry or a select committee having an inquiry, and everyone comes to the same conclusion because the situation is what it is. So any intelligent... group that has an inquiry comes to the same conclusion. There's fundamental structural problems, and self-governance is always going to be flawed, and an independent regulator would actually do football a favour, right? But a government never gets round to doing anything, partly because football goes to it and says, look at all the great work we do, look at the great work we do in the community, you don't want to be imposing an independent regulator on us. And the other point to that is the government at the moment is busy with a very, very huge mess of its own making. And I just don't think there's going to be any time for an independent regulator for football. And so therefore, that means football has just got to get its house in order. And this is an awful thing, isn't it, that's happened. You know, I mean, I've got personal affinity to Bury, and it's part of what I think of as home. But you guys don't. But you all feel... like this could have been any club, and every football supporter is really saddened by this, aren't they? It's not just Bury supporters, and so the FA, the EFL, and the Premier League, you know, they they know that their rules aren't fit for purpose, so they just do need to put in place the rules required to make sure these things don't, you know, have got the least possible chance of happening again.
Well, David, I agree that a lot of fans seem to be the opinion, oh, it's not going to happen to my club. And indeed, in the past few days, I've seen photos taken a few years ago, not in the long, too distant past, of Bury fans mocking Blackpool fans who, when their club was in trouble. We have Bolton fans waving money at Leeds fans when Leeds were in trouble. And the chickens have kind of come home to roost for them. And I'm not having a go at those fans, but it could happen to anyone, and it almost certainly will happen to a lot more clubs. Do you agree?
Yeah, and you're within your rights to have a go at those people. You know, I mean, we don't have to give a free pass to everyone. That kind of football support isn't my kind of football support. Mocking other clubs and, trying to, you know, be happy to dance on their graves. And you know, it's the solidarity between clubs. So, obviously, they're rivals. Like, football is a sport with winners and losers. But the solidarity between supporters where there's a shared love of the game itself, that's the support, that I celebrate and cherish.
Sure.
And
look, if there's no opposition, there's no game, right?
Yeah, so they're opponents, they're rivals, but share mutual respect and, a shared love and appreciation of the game. And there has been solidarity. And Barry, that has happened, and that should be acknowledged, and that should be discouraged. And people should say to those fans, look, the chickens can come home to roost at your club there, but for the grace of God, go you. So have a bit of solidarity with these situations. David, but there has also been some quite, some very touching solidarity as well, hasn't there, throughout this this crisis? And when the Bury fans were hopeful that the club was going to be saved and they had that clean-up of Gig Lane, you had fans of other clubs, Bolton, Blackpool, Leeds, who'd been in crisis, actually coming with, you know, to put rubber gloves on and mop the seats down at Gig Lane. And that's rightly celebrated as, something that people feel is like the best of being a football fan.
Just finally, David, it seems so arbitrary that of these two clubs, one disappears and one stays in business, but Bolton Wanderers fans will be mightily relieved that this takeover has finally happened.
Yeah, I know it does. And if you don't mind me going back into those technical details that, you know, aren't what people support football for.
Yeah.
I would say that the key difference there, just in terms of how it happened, is that Bolton did go into administration. So you have then an administrator, a professional person, an accountant, whose job it is to find a future for the club. And Bolton is, you know, a better prospect for investors than Bury, because it is a big club where you have a chance of getting into the Premier League and, you know, having the financial bonanza. Whereas Bury, you've got to buy Bury either because you just think that it's something you should get involved with, or, you know, you've got some kind of clever plan for making a lower division club work. So Bolton was a better prospect. And unfortunately, Bury never actually went into administration. They did have that CVA, but it was all up to Steve Dale, you know, because the administration sort of took it out of Ken Anderson's hands at Bolton. But at Bury, it was still all up to Steve Dale. Will you sell? Will you talk to people? And one reason why it ended up going the way it did, he just left it so late to start talking to buyers. And it is actually quite difficult to take in that there is going to be no football at Gig Lane. You know, just the physical reality of that, when you know Gig Lane and when it's been, you know, just a fixture in your life. And as I say, you know, I'm not someone who goes to a game there every week, and, you know, it's nothing, it doesn't affect me in anything like the way it affects supporters, but it's just so needless.
Well, listen, David, thank you so much for explaining it and, of course, you know, adding that emotion to it, which is totally vital, because it could happen to any club, couldn't it? David, thanks for your time.
Thank you, guys. Thanks a lot.
David Conn there, who's done extensive work on that. I don't know. I naively felt that, oh, it'll be fine.
Yeah, I think it is the experience that people have over the past 10, 20 years that clubs quite regularly get into financial difficulties, but there's always somebody who comes in to buy them. You think about, you know, a far more prominent example, you know, Aston Villa barely a year ago. But I think David's right to point out that there were other things going on here rather than an absence of buyers. There's still sort of rumours going around Bury that there would have been people who were willing to step in. It was about saying to Steve Dale, you know, you either give up and go now, or you know, or we are going to make an example of you, and that carries with it political consequences, which I think David talked through quite well there about who takes the responsibility for this. But you know, you do worry a little bit that once the precedent has been set, there will be other occasions where there are going to be people saying, well, that you allowed that to happen to Bury, why is it not happening now?
Well, I support Blackburn Rovers, and David mentioned that he's concerned about the Championship in particular, and Blackburn for the last 5-6 years under Venkies have made losses of between 10 to 20 million every season, and in some cases it's been nearing 30 million. And Venkies, sort of to their credit, have actually stumped up the cash basically out of their own pocket. There's not really any financial fair play rules that mean that they can't invest that money, and that's their decision. But it basically the whole future of the club is at this point just based upon a couple of people, and maybe next season they'll think, oh, actually, I don't want to move all my money in there.
I mean, you know, I think to try and find some kind of silver lining, you know, one of the clubs that has been sort of most outspoken about Bolton and the way they've been run has been Forest Green Rovers, because they lent a player to Bolton, never got paid, and had a real to-do over allegedly being conned in the process. And you know, Forest Green Rovers are a self-sustaining local football club, you know, with this great eco agenda as well. My club, you know, we might well be naive in the Premier League and coming down to the Championship quite quickly, but we've changed our model to make ourselves self-sustainable. We are not going to put our hands in the pockets. And what has happened is that we, at least in this moment in time, we have a much closer bond between supporters and the team, because A, that's something the club has been working on, and B, because of necessity, we've started playing more academy players, and that's something that our supporters identify with. So in terms of the football going fan, which I think is very different from the TV watching football fan, Miguel Delaney wrote a really good piece on this in The Independent this week. You know, you have to, if you're not going to be in the Premier League, you have to build something that's going to make people want to come out. And I think there are some good examples of how clubs are thinking about this.
That sort of ethos is really important in the Manchester area as well, where there are a lot of clubs.
I mean, the number of clubs is, it's unsustainable, right?
I think in Greater Manchester, of which Bury is not one, it's just outside, I think there's seven, and that's for a population of about 2.5 million. You know, it's, so London is three times the size, and I think has maybe 10 or 11 football league clubs. So exactly that. If all those people, I mean, a lot of my family are from Bolton and Blackburn, believe it or not. And, you know, you would walk around those towns, and now you're seeing Manchester City shirts all the time. You're even seeing United shirts based upon what's happened in the last 10 years or so, or 8 years. And, you know, if clubs are to bring in these people through the turnstiles, they do need to create a link to the team. And in, as Paul was talking about, that can be in a variety of different ways, but there does have to be a sort of different rethink. I think that is slightly different to what's happened with Bury. I think that's down to, you know, a select few people and their mismanagement. But, you know, for the wider point of football and for clubs going forward, that's a really important consideration.
Just quickly, because I was speaking to a Bury player yesterday about the situation that the players have found themselves in and how they're dealing with that. And his agent, it was an agent of another player, in fact, who was saying to me that he's a Manchester City fan and he would always go and watch Man City at home. But when Man City were away, Bury were the sort of team he'd go and watch on the other Saturday. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many clubs in a small area have existed, because people would sort of just, you know, have your first team, but you'd also have a second team. But you needed to watch football every Saturday.
My family are season ticket holders at both Aki Stanley and Blackburn.
There you go.
Wow, that's a lot of football.
Yeah.
Well, you know, back in the day, you'd go and watch, you know, Spurs and Arsenal, you know, when it was a less tribal affair.
Just one thing about Bolton. They have played, what is it, 5-6 matches, fielding teams of kids, and who have, to their credit, drawn one game and got absolutely battered in the rest of them. Presumably now they've been taken over, they will be able to sign some players, register senior professionals and field a half-decent team. I wonder if the teams that they will play in the future might think it's quite unfair that the teams they've already played have been more or less got a bye or a walkover against them.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You could, you know, could that change where the title, I mean, it could change where the title goes, you know, that it's possible.
Yeah, just to clear up, in League One now, there will only be 3 relegation places, just for anyone that didn't know, and then everything else will, of course, sort of stay the same, but...
Oh, and then one team will go down from League Two?
Yes. Yes, yeah. Yes, still.
So 3 will go down, only 1 will go from League Two, but the same...
Mm. Yeah.
And 4 up, 3 down, 4 up.
Yeah.
And 2 up, 1 down in League Two?
I think they haven't decided what they're going to do in League Two yet.
Okay, well, someone will explain that better than I just did. right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll talk about the Carabao Cup. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra live shows, Barry. Are you excited?
Yeah.
great. So look, with all that enthusiasm, we arrive in Manchester on the 10th of September. Me, you, Barry, Lars and Jonathan Wilson. On the 20th of September, we're in Leeds. Danny says, if Leeds sells out before payday this Friday, I'm going to lose my shit. To be honest, Danny, I'll be pretty surprised. But look, snap up the tickets today and then Danny will be disappointed. If they all go, Danny, we'll get you in somehow. Me, you, Barry, Wilson and Faye Carruthers will be in. Carabao Cup. Colchester United won on penalties at Crystal Palace, who had just won at Old Trafford. Andros Townsend missed his penalty. Wilfried Zaha came on. Christian Benteke played the whole game. So well done to Colchester. Crawley beat Norwich. Beryl, I think he's called Beryl, which is, you know, the absolute ultimate old woman at bingo name, along with, you know, Alison and the rest of them.
Doris.
Is there a Doris in the Premier League?
Doris DeVries.
Hugo Doris. He plays for... Spurs, yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Beryl Lubala scoring the only goal. His fifth of the season. Norwich made 11 changes. Centre-back Tim Closer went off injured in the first half with a possible ACL, which would end his season already. Are you upset, Paul Mack?
Less so than a lot of people. But, yeah, losing, we're already struggling at... We've looked like we're struggling at centre-half, and to lose one of our four to a season-ending injury is not good. Yeah, I think by making 11 changes, you are not signalling that you're taking that tie particularly seriously, though.
Big win for you, Baz. 3-1 at Burnley for Sunderland.
Yeah, it was a good win. Quite a lot of Premier League teams aren't taking this competition seriously. But a win's a win, and away from home, 3-1 against Premier League opposition is grand. Yeah?
I think it's quite... I'm still puzzled by that sort of strategy on the part of a club like Burnley. To not take this competition that
well, I must confess, I don't know how strong a team
well,
they fielded.
They made a lot of changes, but they still had quite a good line. So they've got a deeper squad than you think. You know, Jay Rodriguez scored his first goal back at Burnley. Danny Drinkwater played his first full game since March. He passed the ball to an unmarked Will Grigg for Sunderland's first goal. Still
to be fair,
to do. Joe Hart faced 4 shots, let in 3 of them.
And the one he didn't let in, he parried into the path of Will Grigg, who scored past him. Tom Flanagan. This game could have had a totally different outcome. Burnley took the lead through Jay Rodriguez, and then while they were still one up, hit the upright, the ball rebounded to Jay Rodriguez, who proceeded to smash it against the other upright. So Sunderland were slightly lucky, but yeah, good win.
QPR yet to keep a clean sheet this season. They lost 2-0 at home to Portsmouth, who've been rewarded with a local derby against Southampton in the next round. They won 1-0 at Fulham. Michael Obafemi with his second career goal. First win of the season for Watford. 3-0 at home to Coventry. Villa got 6 at Crewe. Jack Butland, he was left out of the weekend for Stoke. Had another blunder in this game at Leeds. But he did score the winning penalty in a shootout. So well done, Jack Butland. His penalty was good. It was no Kevin Pressman penalty. Forest beat Derby 3-0 in the Cluffy Cup. Everton survived a bit of a scare at Lincoln. Lincoln went ahead after 20 seconds, but a lovely free kick from Lucas Digne, 30 yards out top corner. Gilfie put them ahead with a penalty. Lincoln levered it up, but Alex Iwobi got his first goal for his new club, and Richarlison killed it off.
On the Twitter, somebody was drawing our attention to that second Lincoln goal, which was a fantastic...
Carvalho Andrade.
Yeah, half volley.
Oh, was it a classic half volley?
Yes, in the mode of Harvey Barnes at the weekend for Leicester. Somebody asked, you know, which is better? My opinion would be Harvey Barnes's was better because it came from distance and the ball was looping a lot. But it was really one of those sort of Roy of the Rovers golf shot.
Did it stay hit?
It stayed hit.
Good.
It pinged.
It also sort of completely slips under my radar that Sidibe signed on loan for Everton. Apparently last night he had a bit of a mare as well. I think that was his first like 90 minutes. And it's like a couple of seasons ago when Monaco were going great guns, he was sort of seen as, you know, starting for France. He was seen as like, him and Mendy were seen as like the two fullbacks in vogue. And now he's sort of toiling away at Lincoln. It seems he's only 27, but and who knows, he might go on to have a good season this season. But
so Lucas Digne was a bit of one of those, wasn't he? When he was very highly regarded, went to Barcelona, sort of struggled, and then sort of Everton picked him up as slightly damaged goods, and now he's so, you know, if they can rehabilitate him.
Leicester beat Newcastle on penalties. James Maddison deflected free kick, first goal of the season for Yoshinori Muto, who does look like the guy from goal, right? And he's playing for Newcastle. I know I've said it before. Kasper Schmeichel saved penalties from Isaac Hayden, Jonjo Shelvey, and Jamie Vardy scored the winner.
Did they ever finish the goal trilogy? Because it was supposed to be a trilogy, wasn't
they? They didn't. Is goal three never? Producer Danielle shaking her head.
We should crowdfund it.
Okay.
Goal three.
I mean, there probably are, given what we talked about already, more important things to crowdfund in football. But, you know, I'm happy to stick 50p in for goal three. Bournemouth got past Forest Green on penalties. Mark Travers saved all three Forest Green Rovers penalties after a goalless draw. It's the first time since 2005 that a team have won a shootout in the League Cup without the other team scoring one. An update from producer Danielle. Goal three, taking on the world, came out in 2008. So they have completed it.
Oops, apologies.
Put
to
your
all
money
goal
away. Are there any other games in the we should discuss in the Carabao Cup? I can't think of any.
Weren't Swansea playing? They had quite an emphatic win, I believe. It's quite tight first half. they went in 5-0 up, as I recall. I'm struggling to remember the low rent opposition they faced. Clearly a team who weren't taking the competition seriously, but kept them to just a goal in the second half and lost 6-0.
We did lose 6-0. Ellis James and I were conversing in what he was calling the battle of the Football Weekly pundits. It seemed like they had the better of the first half, and I say hashtag we go again. Hello, they're good Swansea, aren't they?
It's a great learning experience for your guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've surprised a lot of people this season. Steve Cooper, their manager, a bloke I must confess I'd never heard of. He made 11 changes last night from the team that's...
So they weren't taking it seriously. Oh, dear.
11 changes has still won 6-0. And tip of the hat to midfielder Jack Evans, who I think made his debut for the Swansea, his full debut, but he's a cancer survivor.
I don't think Ellis will mind me reading out one of the messages. He's so emotional, isn't he? Like, he's so invested, and it's so beautiful to see. And I was just saying, I love how much you enjoy it. And he just messaged me at half time. I'm tidying away Lego. Caught sight of myself in the mirror. It looks like I've double dropped ecstasy. He says, I've never single dropped it, so Lord knows what double dropping it looks like.
If you look on YouTube, and I presume you won't mind me saying this because it's on YouTube, and there's a
I mean, I'm not suggesting Ellis has done that.
Oh, he has, oh, yes. Okay. Because he does a very good comedy routine. If you Google Ellis James paintballing and ecstasy, it'll come up. It's an absolutely magnificent bit of stand-up where he went paintballing while on a come-down after an E, and he had no money, and he'd forgotten his wallet, and his mates wouldn't give him any money to buy bullets. So he was basically just hiding in a tree for an hour and a half.
Here's a message from Mr. Lancaster saying, idea for the League Cup draw. I didn't see it. I didn't see who did it yesterday. He says, email two ex-pros, come to South Mimms Services Station at midnight. Blindfold them, bundle them into the back of a transit van, location Epping Forest, think Bin Laden camcorder, then the draw is made. Repeat for next round.
That's where it's going, isn't it? They're so hard, trying so hard to make the Carabao Cup draw a thing. It's like own the mistakes, you know, own the sort of the reading out the wrong teams, put them in the wrong boxes, the satellite link delays and stuff, and make it so that, oh, what's the crazy thing they're going to do next?
Wasn't round one in a supermarket?
Yeah. Yes, I was there.
You were there, yeah.
Was it fun?
I was there. No, it wasn't. But it was just, you know, you summarise it in one sentence. They're doing their drawing around the first round of the Carabao Cup in the Morrisons in Colindale, and it's funny, you know. So I think are you undermining the prestige of this great tournament by doing this? Oh, absolutely not. But I'm pretty sure that it's a banter. They're trying to do a banter competition.
Hmm. Oh well, I mean, I'm quite. Exactly. I mean, nothing will beat Rodney, not Rodney Marsh, Rod Stewart, that's the one. Do you remember Rodney Marsh's version of We Are Sailing? It's a really good one. Nothing will beat Rod Stewart's Scottish Cup draw, but they gave it a good go. Look, exciting games. Colchester's prize for getting past Palace, they're home to Spurs. Preston play Man City, MK Dons v Liverpool. I got this tweet.
Who'd Sunderland get?
Oh, good question. You have got Sheffield United away. Mm-hmm. You don't want that. It's a game you lose, and there's no glamour in it at all. And a tweet from someone. I've forgotten your name. It said, due to the impending Carabao Cup game, MK Dons v Liverpool, I have a dilemma. I've supported Liverpool my whole life. MK Dons are my first football experience and my second team. Who do I support from a distressed 17-year-old?
Liverpool. You've supported them your whole life.
There you go. Rochdale, they go to Manchester United. Luton will play Leicester. Chelsea against Grimsby or Macclesfield. Nottingham Forest go to Arsenal. For the full draw, go to a website of your choice. Champions League qualifiers as well finished last night. This week saw Club Brugge, Slavia Prague, Ajax, Dinamo Zagreb, Red Star Belgrade and Olympiacos qualifying for the group stage. A draw which is taking place probably after you hear this, but before we finish it. No,
the other way around.
After we finish this, probably after you've listened to it.
Either way, we all know the draw by the time anyone is listening to this, apart from us right now. Pot one is the champions of the Champions League, the Europa League, and the six top leagues by coefficient. So, Chelsea getting pot one with Liverpool, Barca, City, Juve, Bayern, PSG, and Zenit St. Petersburg.
Please stop talking.
What for the whole?
Coefficients and pots. Nobody's interested.
Do you think? I think people are.
Nah.
I quite like doing the draw myself with Kinder Egg. If you get Kinder Egg things, you can do it yourself. Spurs are in pot two. You know what the draw is by now. We'll react to it. On the next pod, there are plans to expand the Champions League 2024-25 to four groups of eight. So you would play both teams. You wouldn't play each team once. You'd play each team home and away. So it would involve, I think you need to win 17 times to win the Champions League now, or win or play 17 games. It would be 21 games. And there will be a Europa League and a Europa League 2. Only the Premier League are against it. By all accounts, La Liga, Bundesliga, Serie A. The smaller clubs have now seen the dream of Europa League 2 and are in for it.
Well, we all know why the Premier League are against it, because it's going to sort of detract from the glamour and result in less cash for all involved, isn't it?
And also burnout.
You know? Yeah, burnout. And I wonder if fans in the Premier League would rather, you know, Wolves fans would rather play Southampton than a team who are 14th in the Bundesliga.
I mean, this is the, you know, as much as anything, this is about, I imagine, this is a strategic attempt to try and curtail the growing power of the Premier League. Because right now, there's a battle for TV viewers all over the world, and the Premier League is winning it. And UEFA and all the other leagues in Europe are looking at this going, well, how do we get back at it? You're obviously, you have your individual league strategies, but they've probably got a better chance coming together in the Champions League and saying, look, here's all the stars, and they can do it midweek.
But the thing is, Paul, for all we talk about it and the publicity it generates and people get excited about it, hardly anyone in the UK actually watches the Champions League. You know, because BT Sport have the rights and hardly anyone, their viewing figures are absolutely pitiful.
Yeah, I mean, if you're watching it by official means, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it is so easy to stream the Champions League that that's how the younger generation are watching. But I think this is about elsewhere in Europe saying, how do we stop English football from hoovering up all the money?
I just don't know where they're going to get the time from. You know, they've all got winter breaks. You know, they've got to get at least another round of fixture. I don't quite.
You'd be playing every midweek, basically.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
At the moment, you have two on, two off, or something like that.
It's just crazy. And, you know, when they're talking about the European Super League, it being 6-10 of the biggest clubs, and then they're also simultaneously talking about diluting, you know.
This is a compromise, isn't it, to sort of stop a Super League? So you can have something like it, you have lots of games between bigger clubs.
Well, yeah, it just lessens the importance of each of the national leagues.
The ludicrous part of it is in the League of Eight, if you come in the top four, you qualify for the next round of the Champions League. If you come fifth in the League of Eight, you qualify for the Champions League for the next year. So you could come second in your Champions League group, but if you don't, you'd have to then qualify to get in the next Champions League through your domestic league. But if you come fifth in that League of Eight, you're in next year's Champions League. And you are all looking at me completely baffled, which is the correct response to the first time you hear that bit of it. That's so that teams who are sort of 6th, 7th and 8th keep playing for the end of the Champions League. Otherwise, you go, oh, we're out of this, and you stop playing. Mm. Totally ludicrous. Tonight, the Europa League group stage team list will be finalised. Wolves host Torino. They're trying to build on their 3-2 win in the first leg. Linfield travel to Karabag with a 3-2 lead. It'd be amazing if Linfield managed to get past them. Celtic going to Stockholm with a 2-0 win from the first leg against AIK, while Rangers play Legia Warsaw in Glasgow.
Linfield are taking so few fans to Azerbaijan, because obviously it's a very hard place to go and expensive and all that. But they actually named them on their website yesterday. There's three Linfield fans travelling.
Oh, that is glorious, isn't it? Are they going in a tiny plane?
I don't know.
Well, it's just the team. They should go with the players,
just,
right?
Just get them on the team bus, I reckon.
Yeah. Now, Rangers will not ask for any tickets for their next European away game after receiving another UEFA charge for sectarian singing. They are liaising with UEFA after being sanctioned for, quote, racist behaviour during the first leg of their Europa League playoff tie with Legia Warsaw in Poland last week. They've already been ordered to close part of Ibrox for today's second leg after a similar breach in their first round tie against St. Joseph's in July. They have to leave at least 3,000 seats empty, display a banner with hashtag equal game. A club statement said fans responsible for this partial closure need to understand that they are damaging our club. They warned that a further incident in the second leg against Legia could lead to a ground closure. And finally, in part two, we should say rest in peace, Junior Agogo. A tragic story this week. Died at the age of just 40. He suffered a stroke 4 years ago, won 27 caps for Ghana, scored 12 goals and played for a host of Football League sides who've all either paid tribute or will do this weekend. That'll do for part two. We'll round up any other business and look ahead to the Premier League in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Hey guys, exciting time today. It's the UEFA Player of the Year Awards in Monaco. They'll name their Men's Player of the Year today. The three people up for it: Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi and Virgil van Dijk. Who gets it? Does anyone care?
I don't care, and I guess Lionel Messi.
Is this based upon their performances in UEFA competitions, or is this just...
I'm not here for questions of that sort of nature, Michael. This
coefficient chat goes out the window when it comes to awards.
Yeah, give it Messi.
Till the end, give it Messi to the end of the season.
I think give it Van Dijk. I mean, they won the Champions League. That's probably the biggest in a non-World Cup Euros year. That's probably the biggest trophy you can win. He was their most impressive player, impressive in the Premier League as well. And it's great to have a defender who's, you know, stands out and has a bit of charisma about him as well.
It's crazy that there's not an Ajax player in there either, but, you know, and that, you know, they went and beat Juventus and Ronaldo, but that's just...
I think they should give it Van Dijk and have it presented by Dick Van Dyke.
There we go, who's still alive.
Yes, and recently went viral for singing Chitty Chitty Bang Bang in a diner somewhere in...
I think it's probably not a detail you need for him to be still alive, because if he wasn't, it would make the awards ceremony slightly Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah, very exciting.
Something to think about for the Carabao Cup.
Yeah, the corpse of aging TV stars being sort of
George
pushed on a
Best
golf...
will draw the first round of the Carabao Cup tonight.
On a golf cart, being with two people next to them moving their arms. Well, I guess... It's one way of doing it. There was one diagnosis murder where there were five Van Dykes. Because Dick, I mean, nepotism is not dead in the world of diagnosis murder. Because Barry Van Dyke, and obviously I think it's Steve Van Dyke, is the sort of square-jawed son of Dick. And then three others came in.
There's a couple of grandchildren, certainly.
Mm.
So is diagnosis murder your silent witness? Is this the thing you could write a 600-word... humorous critique.
No, that's Death in Paradise.
Producer Danielle says, did Dick dress up as someone else? You know, sort of like Eddie Murphy playing every role. No, I think there were five separate Van Dykes. Perhaps Dick dressed up as, you know, his crazy brother as well. Who knows?
Is this like, so these people have been named after Dick Van Dyke in like tribute? Their parents were fans or something?
No. It's five of the same family.
Oh, wow.
It's called nepotism, Michael.
Oh, yeah. I need to look that one up.
Should we look at the Premier League games? Southampton Manchester United is the early kickoff on Saturday. Inter have agreed a loan deal to sign Alexis Sanchez. Is anyone surprised that anyone would want Sanchez? What could you possibly have seen in the last 6 months?
Nothing. But it's Antonio Conte is taking him on, isn't it? And if he is willingly gone to work with Conte, he knows he's going to have absolutely going to be murdered to the point where he reinvents himself for an Indian summer in a less competitive league.
Manchester United have to pay 40% of his wages, apparently. So there's a feature in The Athletic today talking about that move, and Adam Kraft and Laurie Whitwell wrote it between them. It's an interesting piece, actually. I don't know why I'm saying actually. There's no reason why it shouldn't be. But apparently he was not well-liked at all in Manchester, or at the Manchester United training ground, and his ridiculously large salary, as you can imagine, caused a lot of problems around the club because it upset various other players. And apparently it's the first thing that any agent who goes in to negotiate a deal at Old Trafford brings up is Alexis Sanchez's salary and how little he does to earn it. And if he's getting that much for doing nothing, surely my client should get a lot more for his... superior
just
contribution.
Baz, it sounds like an interesting article. Could you screenshot it for me and send it to me?
I can do that. Yeah. I can print it off for you.
Oh, thanks, mate.
You can read it the old-fashioned way.
Chris Smalling's also going on loan to Italy. Did this raise any eyebrows? Roma have agreed a deal with United for the rest of the season.
That's great news. I mean, great news for him.
Yeah, I agree.
It's really good. But didn't he sign a new contract about 6 months ago?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And it's just another sign of Manchester United's great strategic thinking.
Does Chris Smalling going to Roma now mean that Dejan Lovren won't be going to Roma because they've been after him, apparently?
You would presume so. Would you like to see Lovren and Smalling together?
It's not something I fantasise about.
in a purely footballing context.
That's what I was talking about. Okay, I didn't mean in a... sex way.
Okay. In any way, you have never... there's been no fantasy at all involving Lovren and Smalling together. What about individually?
The two of them perhaps holding hands, dancing through a meadow.
Hmm.
But yeah, why not?
That could be Roma's, you know, announced video, couldn't it? If they go together. Zlatan says he's open to a return to Manchester United when his contract ends in November. He said, I could play easy in the Premier League. If United needs me, I'm here. So that's good news.
The funny thing is about Sanchez leaving is that this weekend, if Martial's not fit, I think unless they call up someone like Mason Greenwood, Rashford is pretty much the only option. I'm not suggesting that Sanchez is ready to start a Premier League game or, you know, but it, Manchester United are woefully short, which is what sort of Zlatan was riffing on.
Mm-hmm. Chelsea play Sheffield United, Palace Villa, Leicester Bournemouth, Brighton go to Manchester City, Newcastle Watford, a six-pointer already. West Ham play Norwich. The late kickoff is Burnley Liverpool. Liverpool have rejected accusations of mentally bullying teenage forward Bobby Duncan. He's the cousin of Steven Gerrard, 18 years old. Apparently Fiorentina wanted him. Liverpool want to keep him. His representative is a man called Saif Ruby. Says Duncan's been kept at the club against his will. The Reds described Ruby's comments as unfounded allegations. Jamie Carragher on Twitter, you know, quote tweeted Ruby's statement saying, I know Bobby and his family well. He's young and at that age, we all want everything right now. Played for the first team in pre-season, which is a great start. He should try and develop this season. Make the bench in the Carabao Cup. That should be the advice you're giving him. Any thoughts on the matter?
Well, Saif Ruby's statement, while appallingly written, was deeply critical of Liverpool, the club, and their director of football, and you would think it is not particularly helpful or a mark of good representation and what you would expect from the agent of a young boy to be airing dirty laundry like that so publicly. Jamie Carragher's involvement is kind of irrelevant. It's not really any of his business, but yeah, if I was that kid's parents, I would be quite distressed at this row such as it is being aired so publicly, you know. And as I say, Liverpool have denied any wrongdoing.
I kind of feel like, you know, of all the many unsavoury aspects of modern football, having agents who want to make themselves the story is one that particularly gets stuck in my throat.
I couldn't agree more. On Sunday, big game in the race for the Everton Cup as Everton play Wolves at 2, and the North London Derby is the late kickoff on Sunday. I don't know. I think Spurs fans are quite nervous at the moment, and I think Arsenal could win this game. I don't know what anyone else thinks.
Yeah, I feel that. I mean, I watched the one last year, which I think was at the Emirates with a 4-2.
Yeah, yeah, Aubameyang scored an absolute glorious goal.
It was a fantastic game, really good game, and Spurs really went at it. But Arsenal were just more clinical on the day, and Spurs, I just think, I'm a big fan of Spurs, Poch, Project, everything, but that they can always be pressurised into a mistake. And I think, you know, I think when you've got Aubameyang, you can probably capitalise on that. And there's a lot more pressure on Spurs, I think, to win this game than there is on Arsenal.
Fitbar, Barry, it's the Old Firm on Sunday.
Yep, it certainly is. I'll watch the game. I usually do watch Old Firm games and they're invariably quite good, but I couldn't give a fiddlers whether it's to get 10 in a row or not. I really don't care.
Juve-Napoli, and this is the big game in Europe. A couple of questions. Alan says, has Paul seen any good Tarantino movies recently?
Hey, I published an article on Medium this week because I knew that nobody would ever publish it in The Guardian.
What was it about?
It was about Quentin Tarantino because I went to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood at the weekend and I didn't like it, but I found it fascinating. I think he's basically, my theory is that he's the last guy who gets to have all the money and all the Hollywood toys to basically put his own obsessions on the big screen. So read it on Medium if you want to know more.
I will read it. I hated that film possibly more than I've ever hated any film more. I didn't just dislike it. It made me angry. Yeah. I thought it was so bad.
I got over my anger stage with him quite a couple of films ago. So, but this one, I was like expecting it to be appalling and making jokes about Mexicans and not giving any of the women any serious screen time in the film. But I did walk out when Brad Pitt chucked a can of dog food at a woman's face. So there we go.
I had to do two wee's during it, and that is frankly, that's one too many for a movie, isn't it? I'm only 40.
Interestingly, we all went to see it. though. That's the thing. He still has a fan base that will go to the cinemas. It's actually been quite a successful movie.
Well, I know quite a lot of people who think it's fantastic. Right. And Peter Bradshaw gave it 5 stars in The Guardian, which I was baffled by, but there you go. Doctors differ, patients die.
Anyway, look, that'll do for today. Paul, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Michael Butler.
Cheers.
Thanks, Baz.
Welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.